Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
This week, ha-has for Hitler and biking in blizzards. From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio. Thanks for tuning in to Culture Cube. I'm your host, Christetta Borini. Today on our program, we have a mixed bag of great stories. From a portrait of a portrait artist to the privacy conundrum of Facebook, today's Culture Cue is one you don't want to miss. We start the show with an exploration of the humor of taboo subjects. When it comes to the taboo, are we letting our conscience get in the way of a good time? Tess Weinberg reports.
Here's the situation. You've all been here. You're at a party or out to dinner and everybody's telling jokes and having a merry time. Then, someone tells a joke and all of a sudden it crosses the line from funny social commentary to downright offensive. So, where is this line and why is it there?
Certain types of people can get skin cancer even if they wear sunblock. People who are pale or light skinned. People with freckles or warts. People with red hair. Why don't they just say Irish people?
Oftentimes, this line lies with taboo subjects. A common taboo subject that repeatedly causes controversy in the comedy world is the subject of Hitler. There's the YouTube sensation, the Downfall parodies, where the subtitles of Hitler's dialogue are replaced by the subtitles that speak of Xbox and American Idol. And there's also the popular online site, hipsterhitler.com. It has been rising in popularity since its launch in August 2010. The comics are made up of both historical and pop culture references that run with punchlines poking both at Hitler and his crew and the modern-day hipster. But they're not meant to be offensive.
In terms of being offended, I'd say 1 in 100.
That was one of the Hipster Hitler creators, JC.
We rarely get emails that say what we're doing is offensive.
And that was the other creator, APK. They parodize Hitler and his dictatorship because he's kind of an easy target.
I think that anyone who's done horrible things, it makes them an attractive person to parodize because you're never going to really look at offend anyone in terms of like them being pro-Hitler.
The creators illustrate Hitler with distinguishable hipster artifacts. For example, retro glasses, skinny jeans, and screen-printed shirts that say things like Arcade Führer. And apparently, Hitler had a lot in common with the modern-day hipster. Besides the alliteration, he was a vegetarian, he was a failed artist, and he supported animal rights, among other things.
He had this period in Vienna where he lived on the street.
So it's nearly 70 years after Hitler's dictatorship, and it's still considered a taboo topic. So when will we be past this moratorium?
I think people are becoming more sensitive towards it now than they probably were back in the day.
Yeah, I think it's not a sort of disrespect thing. It's just, I think people see that how ridiculous it is that so much power was concentrated in one man at that time.
As we've learned, controversial topics are often funny, but they are also most likely to cause an audience to shake their heads in disapproval. Boston comedian of 20 years, Jim McHugh, was in town at the Joke Joint recently. As a veteran in the stand-up comedy world, he understands the art of laughter, including the amusement from traditionally unacceptable topics.
I don't believe Michael Jackson's really dead. I think he's just been relocated by the Catholic Church.
In stand-up, the whole goal is trying to make people laugh. So you're really not trying to offend anyone because if they're offended, they won't laugh.
You know, like I start out my show, I just lost 68 pounds. I've been stalking a jogger.
It's true. He does.
I'm in a good mood. I just lost 68 pounds. Thank you. I've been stalking a jogger.
Okay, is there somebody who could be offended by someone making light of stalking? Yeah, maybe there is, but it's kind of funny to imagine a guy following around a woman who jogs and actually getting in shape by doing it. So if you choose to be offended by that and you're that thin-skinned, you probably should stay out of a comedy club.
So the goal isn't to flat out offend people. So in comedy, why do people choose taboo topics at all?
Tragedy equals comedy sometimes. Somebody could find something offensive in everything.
Sometimes we need these controversial topics because they pull the audience in.
You know, if you start talking about Hitler, it builds a tension. Everybody in the room gets a little bit tense. And then if you go a different direction, that's where you laugh because it's the release of tension. So most people that I find get offended at the setup. They don't wait for the punchline.
It seems like there's a recipe for good comedy.
Comedy's like making stew.
With ingredients and everything.
It's a subject, building tension, and then misdirection and surprise. You know, you just keep adding and boiling it down, you know, till you get what's the hearty good stuff.
It's hard to define what's offensive because we all have our own opinion on what's offensive and what's not.
The only thing that's offensive is not being funny.
For Culture Q, I'm Tess Weinberg.
Since 1901, the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded annually to celebrate individuals who've done great work in promoting peace around the world. But one local photographer has taken a particular interest in the prize and its recipients. Joe Krall brings us the story.
Since a chance opportunity in 1991, local photographer Doug Knutson has tried to capture peace. From the cheerful grin of the Dalai Lama to the apprehensive grimace of Elie Wiesel, Knutson has dedicated the last 20 years to a series of intimate portraits with a unique focus, the Nobel Peace Prize.
The very first Nobel Peace story that I photographed was Betty Williams. She's from Northern Ireland and the 1976 Nobel Peace Laureate. And that's when my alma mater, Luther College, was hosting the Nobel Peace Prize Forum. And I found a way to talk myself into the opportunity of photographing these people. And then about half an hour later, I photographed my second Nobel Peace Laureate. It was Oscar Arias Sanchez.
Each of the 17 portraits in the series reveals Knutson's ability to overcome the unique challenges associated with photographing some of the most famous people in the world.
The photographic side of figuring out how to photograph them and thinking of how these people have been photographed so often, how do I make my picture better represent them than what these other people have done? And I think in some cases I've succeeded very well. It's just trying to determine that. How am I going to interact with them? How are they going to interact with me? How should I make my lighting? What kind of doing it backstage? What kind of environment or lighting am I going to be able to use to best communicate that?
His session with South Africa's Desmond Tutu, however, reveals the complications of obtaining a portrait that is as much the result of circumstance as preparation.
And it was such a busy day that he was a speaker at the Westminster Town Hall Forum that at the last minute they made me move from where I was set up to another spot. And I was kind of irritated about having to move at the last minute, but them making me move really made the picture because they made me move into this other room where I was able to get these stained glass windows behind them that almost looked like angel wings.
The project, Knutson tells me, has given him the opportunity to meet and interact with some of the most momentous figures of our time. An experience that came to a head for him during an epiphanous 2001 photo session with the Dalai Lama.
I took this picture backstage at Northrop, and from that whole tour of the United States, I think I'm the only one who had a formal portrait session with him. All the other pictures I saw were just snapshots of the event. And it was so amazing to shake his hand and meet him and, say, "Oh, Your Holiness, nice," And so I did have all these other pictures to do, but we did the portrait first. I did three frames. I moved in a little closer. I looked at him and I said, "Ah, come on, you can give me a bigger smile than that, can't you?" And so he gave me this little kind of impish grin and I got that picture and boom, I knew that was it. And so I just, at four frames, I quit and I went to the lineup photos. And it was just a special feeling to meet him and to almost, there is almost an aura about him that was pretty fascinating.
In spite of the magnitude of the figures he photographs, however, the most important lesson that Knutson has learned from this project has been about our own potential for growth, a potential that gives him hope for the future.
Everybody at one time is inexperienced and kind of unknowing. But yet we all reach a point then when, you know, we don't know where we're going to go. All these people that won this Nobel Prize were at one time little children. But it's what we do with our potentiality and the way we work towards our goals and the way that we're persistent towards that. And I guess I feel lucky every day that I'm doing this.
For Culture Q, I'm Joe Kroll.
As the semester drags on, students like reporter Monica Castleman start to miss some creature comforts. She asked some gophers what foods they crave the most from back home.
I like pie, I like cake, I like anything you bake.
I miss Nutella on toast.
I'm actually from Houston, Texas, so food I miss the most is barbecue. It's really hard to find good barbecue food up here in Minnesota.
So I really miss Kong salad by the beach, in the ocean, with a pina colada.
I'm very German, so I miss all German food that my grandma used to make.
The food I miss from back home is just like my dad's homemade cooking.
I miss having steak because when you're in college, you can't really afford a nice juicy steak.
I really miss all of like the home-cooked meals and like the grilled meals because all of my food right now is on the go. If it can cook in a microwave, then it's good to go.
I miss grandma's pot roast.
The food I missed from home is my mom's lemon poppy seed bread.
One home-cooked food that I miss is venison.
I miss my dad's popcorn balls.
With the rise of social media, traditional means of communication have vastly changed. Our next story from Yi Chin Lee investigates the constantly updating hyper-personal reality of Facebook and Twitter.
Facebook, the world's largest social networking site, has more than 500 million users now, and the second most popular site, Twitter, has almost 200 million users. In the new social world, we've never been so connected while at the same time being so alienated. Assistant Professor Shayla Teal-Stern teaches a new media culture class at the University of Minnesota, and she explains how social media are changing the interpersonal landscape.
I'm good, how are you?
Good, have a seat.
In one way, they really bring people closer. And that's because you're sort of in constant contact with everybody, or at least you have the opportunity to be in constant contact with all of your friends. So you can see what they're doing every second of the day, either on Facebook or on Twitter. On the other hand, the second way people often think of social networking sites is that they make it so that we don't necessarily have to have much face-to-face contact with the people in our lives.
Mandy Majorovich, a student from the U of M, uses three social networking sites.
Facebook and Twitter, and I do have a MySpace, don't go on ever anymore. And then I also have a Team Ulm account, which is like a social media based in Germany around the city of Ulm, which is where I stayed when I was in a junior in high school, when I stayed there to study abroad.
Mandy uses these sites for different purposes. She uses Facebook and Team Ulm to contact people she knows, and Twitter is to follow news, people she knows, and things that she's interested in. Recently, Mandy has been using Twitter more often while she uses Facebook less. Sometimes she doesn't go on for a couple of days at all.
And I'm just kind of like tired of Facebook, but it's still there because it still helps me connect with other people and like talk to people who I might not be as comfortable with, like getting their phone number or something. So it's good to contact people there.
Mandy lives on her own, so she doesn't have many chances to see family. She says Facebook makes them more connected with each other through pictures and statuses, especially with her mother, who lives in Wisconsin, and relatives she doesn't see very often.
So it's nice to like be able to see those things, because like, I know before I had a Facebook, like I had no idea what anybody was doing. Like, I mean, the family get-togethers and stuff, like it'd be Christmas and, you know, oh, Jason has a new girlfriend. It's just like, who is this? Like, you bring a different girlfriend every single year, you know?
Although Facebook is a convenient way to keep in touch with her family, she thinks that she talks to her mother on Facebook more than they meet face-to-face.
My mom was, like, in Minnesota. I was like, hey, I wanna cook for you. And she's just like, oh, no, I gotta go home. I'm just like, really, Mom? Like, this is your chance to spend time with me. Instead of taking that opportunity, she went home. And then, like, you know, a week later on Facebook, she's like, I really miss you, da-da-da-da-da. And I'm just like, I miss you too, Mom. Really wish you could have spent time with me.
Social media has definitely changed the way we communicate. According to a study from the Pew Research Center, 85% of participants think that by 2020, the internet will be a positive force on their personal friendships, marriages, and other relationships. So, is online socializing and communication a positive or negative influence to our relationships?
It's just something we have to get used to. So, it's going to have both positives and negatives. And I think that the key will really be to train, especially kids, to use it responsibly. And I mean that in terms of having good just being civil to one another online, and not oversharing, thinking about privacy a little bit. So I think that while there are some negative aspects of it, as a culture, we just need to deal with them, because this is what it's going to be.
So what are the positives of social networking sites in our social lives?
Because it is one more way that people can connect with one another. And it is another way that you can sort of articulate your identity to other people in a way that you're in control of it.
It's hard to say whether the holiday season is affected by social networking sites or not. Professor Thielstern thinks it depends on the family and the people. However, the traditional ways of celebrating the holidays and sharing the joys, such as sending greeting cards, has been changed to an extent.
I can say from personal experience, I think I get a lot fewer holiday cards now, because a lot of people will give them or wish you greetings on Facebook. And that's kind of nice, too. It's really immediate. On the other hand, it's kind of nice to open your mailbox and get a card.
For Culture Q, this is Yichen Li.
One month into the new year, and already people are slacking on those New Year's resolutions. Shelby Thomason joined me in studio to discuss the top 7 worst New Year's resolutions that you've probably already broken. I'm joined in studio today by Shelby Thomason.
Hola, Krista.
Hi, Shelby. Thanks for being here with me today.
No problem.
So what is our number 7 most often broken New Year's resolution?
The number 7 resolution is just your typical resolution, which basically means dieting.
And why do you think that dieting is so easily broken directly after the holidays?
Well, especially in Minnesota, it's really hard to get yourself out there kind of in the winter, because it's a really great excuse to be like, oh, you know, I don't need to lose the weight till March, because it doesn't get warm till March.
Yeah, and you need that layer of warmth.
Mm-hmm. You need it.
So we'll push it off until, like, June. And
yeah, and June is, you really only don't need to lose it until June, because that's when it actually gets hot.
By the time June comes around, it's irrelevant.
Yep. It's over. It's over.
So after dieting, what's our number 6?
Number 6 is calling people back and hanging out with people when you say you will. You know, like that typical over break, you see all your high school friends. Hey, you should hang out with me. Like, we should get together.
And you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
No. It's because, like, yeah, you were friends in high school.
Yeah,
great, but I don't know if I have time in my life for you.
It's not that I don't like you.
It's just,
It's not worth the effort.
Uh-huh. Like, I like my other friends more.
Yeah.
But good intentions.
Good intentions. Still can't save the resolution.
No. There is no way to save that.
What's our fifth broken resolution this year?
To be more eco-friendly.
Right. That's a big trend in the past couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Being green and recycling more, but it takes a lot of effort.
A lot of effort. Just like the calling people back and hanging out more one.
Yeah. I feel like it's especially hard in Minneapolis, because even though we're a pretty green city, the recycling truck only comes once every 2 weeks.
That's ridiculous. And, like, that's the biggest thing of being eco-friendly, is recycling.
Right. So if you have to hoard your recycling in your house, then you're not going to be encouraged when you see it piling up
right,
in your mudroom.
Right, and it smells.
You know, if you miss the bi-monthly garbage truck, then it just piles and piles and discourages the good of recycling.
Definitely.
And our number four broken resolution, Shelby?
That would be the overdrafting resolution.
Oh, right. Overdrafting at the bank, getting
having
that $35 fee.
All the time.
Because you're used to spending so much during the holiday season. You know, all that gallivanting and buying presents.
Mm-hmm. And no guilt, because you're buying things for other people.
Right, but then you're in that vein. You're used to that shopper's euphoria. And it's so hard to start saving.
Yeah, instantly stop as soon as you get to January, because now you don't have, like, excuses to buy stuff.
Right. You know, in these hard economic times, start saving, people. Okay, what's our number three broken resolution?
That one has to do with homework, reading the textbooks you bought for, like, $600. Actually using them.
You go to the bookstore and you spend $150,
$400
just to buy textbooks, and then you get to the class and you learn that you only really need the lectures.
Yup. So then those textbooks just sit on your desk.
Unused,
the
unopened.
The entire semester.
It's a waste of money because you sell it back to the bookstore and they only give you $50.
Yup. And you paid $300 for that book.
So I guess the solution to the resolution would definitely have to be renting the textbooks that you can.
Yeah, renting the textbooks or reading them, but let's be honest.
And our second broken resolution, please, Shelby.
Internet trolling.
Facebook, Twitter, that social networking black hole on the internet.
Oh my goodness.
Stumble upon.
Blogging sites, if you're into blogging. Tumblr is a new one.
Mm-hmm. If you get trapped in that infinite loop of refreshing the news feed and creeping on those high school flames.
No way to get out. You think you're not, and then you look at the clock, an hour's gone by, and you have done nothing.
You know, it goes alongside the doing more homework resolution.
Yeah, yep.
They usually come in pairs, those two.
Definitely.
And finally, our number one worst broken resolution.
It's the anti-resolution.
The anti-resolution. Could you explain that to me, Shelby?
Anti-resolution would be like a college student says that they are going to party more this year than they did last year.
That sounds dangerous.
Which really is, it's not a good thing.
Because the new year is all about making a fresh start and being a better person and adding vices to your character. Just, seems like the opposite of the spirit of the holiday.
Uh-huh. That's definitely a new... Ugh.
Well, thank you for joining me today, Shelby.
It was my pleasure.
And once again, this is Chris Stutta.
I'm Shelby.
And this is Culture Q.
While most of us have to summon the energy to warm up our cars in the winter, there's a special breed of hardcore cyclists that gear up for Minneapolis' largest and longest-running alley cat-style bike race called the Stupor Bowl. Zach McCormick explains the origins of the race and shares some exclusive information about this year's event.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
bicycle.
I think it was about 15 or 20 of us rode in mass
down the middle of all the streets to a house in Uptown. And it was snowing. It was a pretty rowdy group, and nobody got hurt. I think everybody crashed at the house that night, and we all participated the next day.
Minnesotans have never claimed to be the sanest group of people in the nation. Some strange urge compels us to take polar plunges, traverse blizzards, and consume our whitefish after being marinated in corrosive chemicals.
Where else? Nobody does this anywhere else. And that's the beauty of it. Our bike culture here is really phenomenal because it's a four-season state.
It's the insanity that drives an increasingly large amount of bikers to bundle up and pedal like mad through the streets every year on the eve before Super Bowl Sunday. It's the special kind of insanity that it takes to be a racer in Minneapolis' flagship Alley Cat bicycle race, the Super Bowl. Gene Oberpiler is the proprietor of One-on-One Bicycle Studio in downtown Minneapolis and a former Twin Cities bike messenger, and he remembers the origins of this unique race.
We were sitting around on a day like today, and it just kind of like, hey, we should have an Alley Cat race. Like at the coldest time of the year. We did a lot of Alley Cats in the summer and the spring, but there was never really any desire to do one in the winter, but then cabin fever sets in.
Nick Gibbons is a working messenger and one of Super Bowl XIV's co-organizers.
It came about as just a really small group of Minneapolis messengers got together, wanted to throw an Alley Cat race. They wanted it to kind of be like a messenger invitational and get, you know, people from neighboring cities like Chicago and Milwaukee to come and, ride in our winter.
Alley Cat bike races have long been the proving ground of bike messengers worldwide. Quick and dirty, unsanctioned races where that all-important street cred could be won and lost.
An Alley Cat is a unsanctioned bicycle race just in the streets. You know, nothing's blocked off. You're in traffic. You're in the neighborhoods. You show up. You get your manifest that has your list of checkpoints on it. And then any which way you want to route that so that you hit all the checkpoints and get to the finish line first.
The Super Bowl has evolved over time into a grand tradition of sorts. Every Super Bowl weekend begins with a pre-registration party, as co-organizer Leif Hansen describes.
Friday night will be a pre-registration party, and we generally rent out a bar. This year it'll be at a pool hall where we will provide people with their registration packet, which will include their t-shirt, koozie, pen, and their first manifest in the race, so they can begin routing in their head and get excited and just really have a great time.
When Saturday rolls around, the Super Bowl divides racers into two categories.
Well, there's two different races you can choose to do. There's the speed race where you get your manifest and you just barrel through all of the checkpoints, you know, get your stamp and leave and go to the next one.
While the pairing of Alley Cats and alcohol has been a long and prosperous one, the Super Bowl's approach to the combination is also unique.
The Super race is generally anywhere from 13 to 18 drink stops, be it a bar or a nice fishing house on Lake Calhoun. Do the shot, go to the next one.
And since the race is clearly not enough of an undertaking already, the Super Bowl organizers occasionally like to make racers work for that manifest stamp. In past years, stops have featured sleds and minnows.
So there was one checkpoint where you go out in the middle of Lake Calhoun and you received a live minnow that you had to bring with you to the end. And for most people's routing, that checkpoint was fairly early in the race. I think a lot of people just put it in their back pocket and rode with it the whole time and then turned in what was sort of a semblance of a minnow. I was the only person that put the minnow in my water bottle and just turned in my water bottle with it swimming around in there.
The reward for victory in either of the races used to be little more than bragging rights between an elite group of riders, but as the Super Bowl has grown, various sponsors have started to take notice, and these days there's some serious prizes on the line. In response, the level of competition is amplified. Riders have begun to use team techniques like drafting and strategic routing between checkpoints as a must. Nick Gibbons was kind enough to share some exclusive information about the race with us for all the potential competitors.
This year's, you're going to have to be a little more on your feet because instead of just getting the one manifest that has all your checkpoints on it, there's going to be three. So you're not going to know all the checkpoints ahead of time. Your routing's really going to have to be on the fly as you go.
So if you think you've got that special kind of insanity it takes to ride for hours at breakneck speeds through the worst conditions the city can throw at you, Stupor Bowl weekend starts Friday, February 4th at Helix Bar on Broadway for the pre-registration party, with the race at 3 on Saturday afternoon. I'd advise you wear a helmet. This is Zach McCormick for Culture Q.
That's our show. Today you heard stories from reporters Tess Weinberg, Joe Kroll, Monica Castleman, Zach McCormick, and Yi-Chin Lee. Host and managing editor is me, Christetta Barini, and our producers are Eric Dolsky, Joe Kroll, and Mark Sheely. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek. If you missed something fascinating, check out CultureQ online at radiok.org. See you next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.